Would like to tell a story about myself on that, how it works. I was over to the Northwest Conference. I think everyone has heard that this morning, but I would like to tell a story about myself on that, how it works. I was over to the Northwest Conference in Seattle in 1965, I think it was, and was in the ballroom of the Olympic Hotel, and I'd been sober a little while, and I'd been asked to read how it works. And smart me, I had learned how it works, so I thought, and I was going to get up there and recite it, and I was standing there looking at everybody and reciting off, and all of a sudden my mind went blank. The book was open in front of me, and I took a few seconds to find it, and then Father Barney, I was sitting next to him, and I went back and sat down. Oh, Father Barney nudged me and said, "You kind of overtrained a little bit, didn't you, bud?" Well, we are going to have some talks from people that have been in AA for a period of time, but after hearing Sybil last night with that 45 years, I feel like a neophyte. And we're trying to tell you people what AA was like when you came in. I came into AA in Yakima in 1960. At that time, we had one meeting in town. And from that very first meeting, I was very enthusiastic about AA. I thought this was a great program for you people. Of course, I was working it partway and continued drinking. And old Cliff one time got a hold of me and said, "What are you going to AA for?" I said, "Maybe I can help somebody." He said, "Jesus Christ, you better help yourself first." But we had that one group, and we were meeting on West Chestnut, up a long flight of stairs, and that, to me, my first trek up those steps was clear to the moon. I knew not what to expect. I hadn't read anything about AA, hadn't talked to anybody about AA, but I came away from that meeting with one thing, and that was hope and faith. And I really got enthusiastic about it, and we talk about control. I don't know why those people allowed me to do it, but it wasn't very long until I had a welcoming committee, I had a finance committee, I had a program committee, and they let me go on. And, of course, it didn't take long before I found out that I couldn't control everything. But we had about 15 members in Yakima, and they were all pretty active, and I think maybe some of you remember some old Cliff. He was very active, and he was gut AA, I'll tell you. And then there was a Kelly that came in about that time, and I got to tell something on this. This fella, it was in AA when I came in, and I think he was an insurance salesman, and he decided to get a degree, and he drove back drove back and forth to Ellensburg every day and got that degree. And he was just about to start on teaching, and he had a physical, and they found him just full of cancer, and they couldn't do anything. They just sewed him up and told him he had about 6 months to live. And he decided, at the same time, he inherited $100,000. And he decided that he was going to go back to Kentucky, where he came from. And he came to the meeting. We had started at that time a second group down at Union Gap. And he came down and gave a talk there that was the most beautiful thing I ever heard. There was no remorse. There wasn't any feeling of resentment about all of this. But he really did tell us what the AA program is and had done for him. Well, as I said, we had this one meeting going in Yakima, and then we decided that we had one fella, Ted B., who was a jeweler, and he was very crippled. He just could hardly get around, but he had some of that we all know about, that pride. And like I said, those long stairs up there, and all of us had at times offered to help him or carry him up those stairs, but no. So we decided we was going to have to start another group. So we went down to Union Gap and got the Episcopal Church down there where he could go right in on a level. And that group is still active. And it was just about this time it began taking off and really a lot of groups starting. And about this time then we had several members there, Bill G, who owned the building where we had our meeting upstairs, and he had an awful time keeping sober. And we finally moved over to 6th Avenue. We got a Ma and Pa empty grocery store, and we decided we could fix that up and have our meetings there. And true to alcoholic form, everybody was very enthusiastic. We had to put up partitions, we had to paint, we had to do so much there. And the first weekend that we got up there and started working on that, we had about 15, 20 people there, and boy, they were really going at it. The second week, there's about 10, and then it took us a long time, and there was two or three of us finally ended up getting the place ready. But it took a long time to get to the point where people begin to come in any quantities, and we had then, this morning I showed a few people of it. In 1964 we had the Northwest Conference there, and I can appreciate the people that put on these conferences, how much work goes into it. But we had a very good conference. We had Governor Rossellini there, Dr. Norris, a trustee from New York. We had Dr. Earl, whose story in the back of the book, Physician Heal Thyself, and the fellow that played Captain Midnight in the series that was on TV. And it was a very successful conference. And I think that the difference that I have seen in groups and the difference in AA since I came in, I felt very much out of place when I came in. I wasn't like those drunks because I didn't experience anything like they had, and so that gave me a good excuse for not admitting I was an alcoholic for quite some time or accepting it. But I think we went along, and I'd like to point out a couple things that I think that AA has changed in the time I've been in there. When I first came in, nobody came in that hadn't lost everything or very near lost everything, that they came in and was seeking help. Of course, not all of them stayed, but they were there at least admitting that they had a problem. And then along came the inpatient treatments, and I was quite opposed to those to start with, and most AA members at that time were very opposed. But it came about that I was asked to go down to Sundown M Ranch when that started, and that was quite an experience because I was the only one there for the first year. I'd never been in a place like that before. I didn't have anybody to give me any guidance. And I'll tell you, they got an awful lot of AA there. And it did seem to work. I think another thing that is different than when I came is that we are getting people in now due to a nudge from the court or from other sources that have found out that AA does work. It's the most effective way of attaining and maintaining sobriety. And it has been recognized worldwide as that. And the courts have begun to recognize that an alcoholic doesn't need punishment. They're sick people. They need help. And so we're getting people in that are really not there because they want to. And I think it's much harder now going into AA because we don't seem to have that dedication. Another thing, too, I think we have so many meetings that we have a lot of meetings and few groups. And people seem to think that attending meetings and not drinking is sobriety. But I think it goes way beyond that. I believe a person's cheating themselves that doesn't get into the 12 steps and work the 12 steps. And that's where the meat of this program is. And I was very interested last night in hearing Sybil and her early experiences in AA. And even at the time I came in, I think we only had two or three women for the first few years until they began to be accepted and recognize that AA would work for women as well as men. So I'm not going to take too much time. I'd like to hear some of these people. I've got a lot more sobriety than I have, and so I'm going to call on one that I think has probably the most sobriety with us here. Eric, would you like to come talk to us?
Thank you, Howard. My name is Eric, and I'm an alcoholic. And I do not have the most sobriety of the people who will be speaking, because Shorty's here, and he's got me by 3 years less 1 month. So, and it's interesting to note that at this conference, we have two people who attended the very first conference. And I know one of them is here this morning, Larry O., and the other is Sam G., who spoke last night just in the opening part of the meeting. And those guys were around when the first meeting was held in 1948. That was the organizational meeting of AA, the Northwest Conference. And that Northwest Conference, for some people don't realize, that was the beginning of that was a precursor, shall we say, of what was to take place beginning in 1951 with the General Service Conference. And some people say, well, it's not important to go to a Pacific Northwest Conference, but I believe it is, because I think there's so much history in the Northwest Conference that I would hate to see us ever leaving the Northwest Conference behind and settling on something which I would say is it's never as good as the first and the best, because the Northwest Conference to me is still one of the finest get-togethers we ever have. And the people that are gathered here today, many of them are my old friends of a number of years, and it's great. And I think of some of the Northwest conferences we had, and I remember that heavy conference when all those people were up at the head table, including the governor, and it was an election year, and the governor had to give a speech to get a few more votes for that fall. And but anyway, it was kind of neat. But the year before that, and you know how people can get together for a conference and they overdo it. And they started out at the dinner in Coos Bay, Oregon, in 1963, I think it was. And when the dinner was over, then they had two speakers get up and speak, and one of them was Ralph from Grants Pass, Oregon. He was a chairman of the Oregon Conference and then of the Oregon Assembly. And I was there that year. I was the chairman of the Washington Area Assembly. And they gave us some time to speak, and I knew that there were a lot of things going to be going on, and I wanted to be nice to the next guy coming up, who was Ralph. I spoke first, and so I only spoke for about 2 minutes. You believe it or not. And then behind me, Ralph got up, and I guess he figured, well, if I'm only going to talk for 2 minutes, that's all he's going to talk is 2 minutes. But then that was the end of the small talk, let's call it. Because then they moved out of the banquet part, they cleaned up the place, and then they started talking. And first of all, there was an Al-Anon speaker. And that Al-Anon speaker spoke longer than most Al-Anon speakers speak. You've seen some other ones, yeah, okay. But anyway, she spoke quite long, at length. Then there's one of the local guys, and I think he was from Portland, and he had wanted to get on the program, so he got on the program, and he talked for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes, besides, you know, what they already had on the program. And then they had an Alateen, and the Alateen was the shortest one of all, only spoke for about 10 to 15 minutes, and they kept on going, and finally it got to Cliff Walker from Whittier, California, one of the first 100 men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was the main speaker. And I thought to myself, boy, I'd hate to be in that kind of a spot. Get up in front of all those people when they're all tired and ready to go home. But he was such a marvelous speaker, and he gave such a beautiful message that night that within 5 minutes, you could have heard a pin drop, because he gave that beautiful, beautiful talk that only Cliff Walker could give. I think of some of the early days in Seattle, and when I came in 1951, I do recall it. My sponsors were all Skid Row winos. All of those guys that talked to me in those early days in AA had been on the Skid Row And they were so grateful for what had happened to them in Alcoholics Anonymous and their recovery that they weren't going to let a live one get away. And I was the live one. And I'd been in there for a couple of hours in the Alano Club on December the 24th, 1951. It was my natal birthday as well as it became my AA birthday. And I, after drinking a whole bunch of coffee, and by this time I was beginning to get a little nervous, and I said, can you tell me where the men's room is? And they said, we'll do better than that. We'll take you there. And they brought me back. And they put me in that same booth, and in the corner, there's a wall here, and in that booth, they put me in that spot over there. An AA member over here so I couldn't get out, and then across from me, two more AA members who were old-timers who had been on the program from anywhere from 6 months to about 3-4 years. And those were old-timers in those days. And in fact, one of the fellows I met is still active and alive in Seattle. He's active in his group in Seattle. One of the things that has been called to my attention the last couple of months, I've been in touch with Shorty. As I go around the state and I talk to different people, and I want to find out where can we find a little bit more about the history. Some of you probably don't know that I'm the editor of the Washington Area History that's going to be published, hopefully, in time for the assembly in the fall. And if anybody has $10, they can give it to me or to Dennis, and we'll give you, you can buy your book in advance if you will trust us. The more books we sell, the more we will publish on the first printing, and the more money we get in, we can finance it so much better. But anyway, as I talk to these people, and I talk to Sam G, 40 years in the program, about 40 or 39, and I talk to Shorty, and they both have the same message, and they reminded me of what it's all about when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You've heard about Back to Basics. The big book, that's the thing that they made sure I got right away. A couple of my sponsors said that I also had to buy another book, which was not conference approved, and that was the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, because that was part of the teaching that they had in before the big book was published. That's what they used. The Sermon on the Mount was part of the Bible, and the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians and the book of James, those small parts of the Bible were used because the Oxford groups introduced them to the people. And so that's why they wanted me to buy that book. But the thing was that they made sure that I got the book and I read it. And they also made sure that they didn't buy it for me. They made me pay for it. Well, at least they didn't make me pay for it, but the thing was that it's the only way I could get it. So, but among the things that I learned, first of all, they asked me, can you stay sober for 24 hours? And the answer was yes. I wouldn't use the word they used, but can stay sober for 24 hours. And so they had me, because that's all I have to do is work the program. I'm suffering from an allergy that condemns me to die if I continue to drink, and an obsession that compels me to drink. So I'm caught up in this vicious circle, and they talk about the illness and the fact there's only one way to go, and that's, you know, you're going to end up in the nut house if you live, or you're going to die, and things are going to be, well, they're going to be bad, aren't they, if you don't do that. But the thing was that there is an answer. The answer, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but let's get with it. Let's stay with the basics, and let's tell the people they've got an allergy, and they're going to have that allergy. There's no cure. If you live, you know, say, there's some allergies that some people get rid of if they live long enough. You know, just because the nature takes its course. But that isn't true of the allergy that we have. We were allergic to alcohol for the rest of our lives, and so we can't do it. And those are the things that Bill and Dr. Bob used to talk about in those early days, was they put it on that transmission line of one alcoholic talking to another. And they said, when one alcoholic carries the message to another person, and that's what it's all about. We've got to get their attention. And you know, some of you have heard that story, which I'm not going to tell, but there's got to be ways. I mean, maybe you got to hit them over the head with a 2x4. But you got to get their attention. I remember some of the things that happened to me when I came in the program, and I recall one especially was, I'd been in the program 3 or 4 years, and they let me become involved with the jamborees that they held in Seattle. Twice a year, in April and October, they had a jamboree, and they would get people with any kind of talent. Tom Hood from Seattle. Apparently, his greatest talent was climbing ladders, because in the big hall in Seattle, they had a stage. And all through the jamboree, there would be Tom. He would be getting his ladder out, and he would be climbing up this long, tall ladder. I would have been afraid to go up there. And he would reach behind the curtain, and he would get his bottle. He'd come all the way down. He'd take a slug out of the bottle. Then he'd get back on the ladder, go all the way up to the top, and then he'd come down. And about every 15 or 20 minutes in between acts and stuff, he would continue to do this. And it was kind of fun. And different acts we had. I remember Mary B. and Bud E. and a couple others did a dance for us with hula skirts, and I think that was one of the times that Mary's, what do you call it? It slipped. But she wasn't too embarrassed, and she managed to pull through that all right. But then it came one year, and it was the last year they ever had the jamboree. They wanted three of us to be co-chairmen of this thing. And I won't tell you their names. I want to protect their anonymity even from their first names. Because what happened was that they found a group of vaudevillians who used to perform at the, what's the name of that theater downtown Seattle where they used to have burlesque and all that stuff? Rialto? No. Well, anyway, whatever it was, it was in this thing. And somebody said to me after our second organizational meeting, I think that gal used to be a stripteaser. And so I, being very naive, but also I wanted to be sure that I knew if she really was a stripteaser. And so I asked, maybe we can have a striptease. She said, oh, boy, you know. She was willing to do it. And I says, no, I just wanted to find out really what it's all about. And I says, no, this is a family thing. We have kids and everything else here, so we don't want that. But the thing was that when it came that night, there she was on the stage, and she was going to do her thing, but I don't know how far she was going to go. But she started to take off a couple of pieces of her overgarments, and I was in the back of the hall. And I was still very shy. I hated to confront anybody about anything, but I came running up to the front and into the wings. You couldn't see me from over there. And I said, hold it. No more clothes off. And the thing was, that's what people remembered for a long time, that I was the guy that had the striptease. And it was they didn't ever want to have one of those again because it's a family affair, so that was the end of the jamborees. I think we've overcome that. Maybe it would be a good idea to try it again sometime in the future. But anyway, the basics we have in Alcoholics Anonymous are the things we learned in the beginning. And it's important to have a group, to belong to a group. And I'm going to close on this one because I think it's kind of neat how naive I was in the first year of the program. Well, in some ways I'm still just as naive as I ever was. I belonged to the Empire We group, which I felt was the best group in the whole world. And I hope you feel the same way about your group. And I was running around with some young people who were about anywhere from about 25 to 35, and they decided they were going to form a group of young people. See, they didn't have the early 20s and the teens in those days, but they were going to form a group, and they were going to call it the 2040 group. I wouldn't even go to their first meeting because I was afraid that if I went to their first meeting, they would throw me out of the Empire Way group. And I would lose my membership in the AA group, and it was important to me right from the beginning that I have roots in AA and that I become a member of a group, and I stay with that group, and I work in that group, and I do these things. And these are the kind of things that they impressed upon me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't even go to a meeting of the 2040 group until they'd been going for a full month. To me, it's important that I belong to a group and I have a place where I can practice these principles. I can have a place where I can bring that newcomer in, because the group is really the most important entity after we think of ourselves. The individual is all important, but the group and the group unity is the most important thing for us as people in Alcoholics Anonymous, so we can bring people to a group. And once I get wound up, I'd like to talk for a long time, but I'm going to close, and thank you very much for this privilege.
Thank you, Eric. And what does it say there? We'll go to any extent your jamboree. Shorty, I'm sorry that I short-shifted you 3 years. Come on and make up for it.
I'm Shorty, and I'm an alcoholic. This is terrific to be a part of something like this. I realize that I've been consistent about something in my life which is very unusual. I've managed to stay sober day by day without a drink for quite a number of years. It's right, I came on the program, took my last drink December 23rd, 1949. And I was in San Francisco. A guy by the name of Jack Irving drugged me off of Skid Row, bumped into me. That's why when I talk about Providence. I was going to commit suicide. I was going to jump off the Bay Bridge. But like everything else I'd done heretofore, I wasn't even successful at that. In fact, I felt very much at home when I came to AA because I found out everybody else there had never been successful committing suicide either. And so he took me under his wing. I won't go into detail, but except to say that I went to my meeting sitting there in the downtown group of San Francisco in the basement of the old French Catholic Church after spending a couple days puking, trying to get out of my system all the things I'd put in it. And I sat there on my hands shaking, absolutely knowing I was in the wrong place. I was brought up in a Methodist minister's home, an old-fashioned Methodist minister's home, the youngest of 10 children. I was brought up where prayer was mandatory before he even ate breakfast. I mean kneeling in prayer and listening to your mother and your dad and your older brothers and sisters and listening to the scripture and all that evening and stuff. So I was there and I found out I was in another religious organization that was going to make a Bible thumper out of me. But Providence saw to it that I sat there and listened. And to this day, something happened after that meeting that has stayed with me ever since, and I kick myself all over when I forget it. Three fellows walked up to me when I was going to go across the street and get drunk, walked up to me and says, "Shorty, come on with us down to the club and have coffee, will you?" And I went with them because that was the first time that I'd experienced anybody wanting me to be with them for a long time. And they showed me and set an example of caring. And to this day, I make it a point. I may be missed once in a while, but if there's a brand new person at the meeting or wherever I am, I don't leave the meeting until I've had a chance to go up and welcome him. Because I think that's one of the greatest assets we have in getting a new person on. That's showing them that we care. I can go back and tell some stories that happened different places when I came on the program, but we had some things that I see has happened. You know, we got some things that we don't think about very often that we're doing. You know, we're a great bunch of people that when something works, we got to fix it. You ever notice that? You just got to fix it. In our phraseology, we're changing it. The things that have made AA. Well, that's old hat. We even got some writings that come out of New York that just drive me crazy. The one thing that's going to kill us is from within. And then they write about the one thing that violates our traditions. The right of decision. You cannot correlate that with group conscience. It's impossible. I have listened to discussions, I've been in on them, and I've never gotten a satisfactory answer. And I'm afraid of it. I'm awfully afraid of it. The experience of AA comes from the group. Dr. Norris and Jim Masterson and I sat here in Yakima in 1964, and I guess we drove him crazy. He wanted to make awfully sure that it was a knowledgeable group conscience. Now, where in the world are you going to get your knowledge if it isn't in the group? I never saw new people come to the conference to get sober. I was there twice myself. I never saw a new guy come and ask for help. The only place I've ever seen any, with a rare, rare exception, is to the group. The group is what knows what's happening. The group is what knows what results they have. The group is knows what's effective and what's not effective. And let's be sure we remember that. You've heard me tell, this is just one great big tent. You've heard me tell about it. Those poles in the middle, those trustees, those delegates, those district committee men on the inside, we might could push a few of them over, but the tent wouldn't collapse. But you go on the outside and start kicking over those little pegs on the outside, the groups and the GSRs that are on the outside of the tent. You just kick a few of them over and see how quick your tent stands up. AA is a group that have gathered together to perpetuate their own sobriety and help others who wish to do the same. That's what AA is. AA is a program that's written on 2.5 pages of chapter 5. They say 100 people did it, but I've been researching the history. It was 70 at the most. And Bill never got together with more than 35 at one time. And he told me personally in Salt Lake City in 1953, he told me we sat all afternoon in the Altrium group together, and he told me, he says, boy, talk about getting raked over the coals. He says, that Jim Burwell, who was come in as an agnostic, he first said he was an atheist and got a little more honest, and he said he was an agnostic, and then he got a little more honest and he didn't know, and he gave me a name that I felt I was, and that was a skeptic about God and things. And they told about Jim hollering at him, and he told about it and making him say, you got to put as I understand him. And he wanted him to put God as I understand him every time it said God in the book. Jim did. They finally made Jim settle. And he told me about the fights they had about getting that worded. That chapter 5, those first 2.5 pages. And he told me that I had to write it the way they, and get in agreement with those people. And here's something that very few can find. I can't find it written any place, and I'm sure he said it when he said to me. He said, you know, I never had much success with the new man, getting him to stop drinking. Never had much success. He says, and when I saw all these people having success, I had to change my thinking. And that told me one thing, what a big man that Bill was. He was a terrifically big man. And every time I read in there where it says, and when we are wrong, promptly admit it, something that wasn't very hard for me to do, but I know the rest of you had a lot of trouble with it. I remember what Bill said, how difficult it was, but he had to do it. And I remember all those things come up from time to time, the different people. I can remember sitting in 1951 in the Davenport Hotel, and they were having the first meeting after it was no longer a quadrant, and it was going to be an area. And the people that were sitting there, O'Malley, I don't know if you were there or not, were you? Huh? Were you at the Davenport Hotel in 51 at that meeting? I think you were, yeah. And there was Chuck from up at Westminster and Kurt Hoare from Astoria. And, there's a bunch of them. Andy Palmersheim from Billings, Montana, and Red from Missoula, Montana. And Sam G was there. And I sat there fairly new in the program, and I was going out on the road for the company I'd started working for, but I sat there and listened to all those men saying, among the ones I heard, they talked, they says, we're a bunch of buddies now. We can't break this up. Let's just continue getting together. And that's the way I understand it at our Northwest Conference Day. It was those people wanted to get together and stay friends. And I think it's beautiful. I think it's a very worthwhile thing. I think it's a real major asset to our AA here in the Northwest. I know I'm an old Bible back. I know I'm an old bleeding deacon. And I realize that I'm not going to be accepted in all I say, but I'm going to keep saying it until somebody tells me, Shorty, where do we find it in the big book, and I can't find it. Then I'll back up. When these people come with all their fancy explanations and details and analyzations, I take them and they ask me to sponsor them if they got guts enough to let me sponsor them. I take them through the ropes, just exactly like I was taken through. That's all I know, is how I got sober. I make them read that chapter 5, not so they know it by heart, but so they understand every word. And I tell them there's two books you're going to have if I sponsor you. One of them is the big book called Alcoholic Anonymous, and the next one's the dictionary, so you can look up what the words mean. If you don't believe that's important, try it sometime. Just look up the honest definition of some of those words. It's important to know it. I came on this program, was going to get off of it because they were asking me to do the impossible. I felt they were going to make me perfect. Try to make me perfect. But my sponsor made me read chapter 5, those 2.5 pages, every night before I went to bed for 15 nights in a row, just over 2 weeks. Slowly, out loud to myself, so I would both hear them and see them. And then's when the words jump out. And you wonder, what really does that word mean? And you look it up in the dictionary. And you got a word in there that they argued over. Bill wanted to put absolute honesty in the steps, and they said, we're not, you can't, there is no such thing, Bill. But he'd learned that from the Oxford group in their absolutes. And they showed him, they come with a word. I forget what he said 2 weeks or 3-4 weeks later. They come with a word that he would accept. And the word is a little different than absolute. I'm trying to think of the word. I have to go back in the thing. Rigorous. Rigorous honesty. And I got to that word, rigorous. What the heck does rigorous really mean? Now, I was getting worried about this program that was asking me the impossible. And lo and behold, rigorous belonged there. And it fitted me because rigorous means doing your very best. And that's all the program was asking of me from then on, to do my very best. And all through it, to tell in a general way what I was like. That I didn't have to have a spiritual experience. I could have just a spiritual awakening, which fit in with the way I was starting to think. And it was a God I understand, and I didn't have to turn my will and my life over until I could have an understanding of who I was doing it to. And if you'll read the third step long enough, it'll say that to you too, you that are having trouble. The program is made for the alcoholic who wants to do something about their drinking. I don't object to people coming sent by the court and sitting there and finding out if the time might come when they want to do it. But I don't like that to be put in our statistics of lack of success, because we've got a statement there that qualifies us. Those first page and a half up to the steps are qualification statements that makes it possible for me to have the use of the 12 steps, which means sobriety. And if I don't qualify, I have no right to expect that this program is going to do the job for me. They can come, and when they qualify, and they do, a lot of them. Another thing regarding that we've lost sight of is how many kinds of alcoholics there are. There's two. Two kinds of alcoholics. The drunk one and the sober one. You show me in the book where there's anything else. He talked about the 2040 group. I joined it down in, I was 39 years old when I came on the program, and I joined it down in San Francisco, the 2040 group. And about the third meeting, I find out it was for people while they were under 40 and over 20. And I said, what am I going to do next year? Well, we have to kick you out. And so several of them decided that they wouldn't be a part of the group in the next couple of years. Why be in it now? And so the whole thing fell apart. And we had other groups, special designated groups. But we forgot. And we don't have too good luck. The percentage of recovery drops tremendously when we specialize. It's been proven time and time again. I know one specialized group that the best we can find out is maybe 1 out of 20 last over a year. That ain't good. There is just two kinds of alcoholics in Alcoholic Anonymous. The drunk one and the sober one. As far as Alcoholic Anonymous is concerned. And we have tools not to fix you up, but first to give you a new life and then tools to maintain it. There's no question about that. So I'm glad you allowed me to be up here. I don't know what I said that's referred to old-timers particularly. I didn't write a speech. I didn't know what we were going to talk about up here. I just thought there's only one shorty as far as I'm concerned with one message. And if I want to change my message, I've got to become a phony. There's one thing you better be sure about when it comes to AA. There's nothing phony about shorty. And I thank God for that. And I thank God for all you people that have reinforced my sobriety for me down through the years. You are wonderful. Thank you.
There's two things Shorty brought up there that hit home to me, and that was if it works, don't fix it. And analyzing. I remember when I came in, I was spoon-fed the big book quite extensively, and it seemed to me that I could change that a heck of a lot and make it easier for you people and me. Why did we have to have two steps on inventory? Take inventory and then continue. Why did we have to have two? Made a list of people we had harmed and then make amends. And that 12th step, there was three distinct parts in there. We ought to make a step out of all those. And analyze and it... I went through the stage, but it hasn't changed one damn bit. So we'll go right down the line, and we'd like to have Barry from Boise talk to us.
I'm Barry, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. And feel very privileged to speak as an old-timer. I don't feel like an old-timer. I always like to get up in the morning and realize that we have a daily reprieve only, and there's no cure for alcoholism, and I ask God to please help me do His will today. I'm a very firm believer in God as we understand God, and the power of God, I believe, is expressed through this group of all of us unanimously believing whatever level we our understanding is of this power greater than self, and selfishness and self-centeredness and self-will run riot, we know, is the root of our problem. And I had that in great depth when I arrived. I was a skid row drunk, and I took great pride in being able to puke out there and never touch my shirt. Some of you haven't heard that about me, but it's better to hear it than see it. It's a little sour. And I was a little sour. I like to relate the word good to God, if you take the O out of good, you have God. If you take God out of good, you have O, and that's what I was when I arrived. So I'm grateful that I can wear clean clothes today and smell clean air and shake hands with people, almost said that wrong, with people that I love very much, which are the people in this room, the people that gave me life, that gave me those absolutes that Shorty talked about, absolute. I don't have all of these things because absolute is a pretty tough word and rigorous is tough enough. Absolute honesty and absolute on selfishness, and absolute love, absolute purity of motive. They came from the Oxford group. My sponsor hits me with those every time I go back to see him. He lives in Waianae, Hawaii, and he's been in the program for 45 years. Dr. Bob was his sponsor. And my sobriety date is January 9, 1959. And so I'm probably the youngest of the old-timers, perhaps. I don't know people's sobriety dates. I know that I love people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a third-step meeting before I came here this morning, and I would like to compliment both of the speakers I heard there. They were tremendous, and They talked about God as I understand God, and that God is a very unselfish, giving God, and not a what I considered when I came here to be an evil God, that he was going to strike me dead, and when I came here I was dead, so I was walking around dead. I like what Dr. Bob says in his story about trust in God, clean house, and help others. What he says is the shadows of the mind. And I don't know what we're supposed to talk about either today, but I really believe what Shorty says, that if we fall apart, we will fall apart from within. And that I think our program is totally a single-purpose program, and if we don't protect it, the Oxford Group divided, and they divided and subdivided and dissolved into a zero that I was when I came here. And we certainly don't want to go back to being zeros. So I'm here today to stand with the rest of the people here and hopefully to do my share of whatever we can give to each other to maintain our sobriety. And I believe very much in our steps and our traditions. The steps I like where we get down, I like that ninth step because that means that we've worked the meat and the hard work of the program, and if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we will know some freedom. And the book tells us happy, joyous, and free. It has many promises. On almost every page we can read about promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I agree with allergy, and I agree with what our book tells us what we have. And I agree with the words in our big book because they're very short and they're very brief. They're simple. And I wanted something more complicated when I came here. As a matter of fact, in my home I have examples of fourth step inventory, and I have some of them that are several inches thick that were given to me by different treatment programs. And I'm not here to argue with treatment, but I'm glad that my inventory was right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took me 10 years to do it. I came to AA in 1954. I don't know what I came for. Reverse psychology, I think, caused it because my wife said it wouldn't work, and I wanted to prove her wrong. And she was right. It didn't work for quite some time. I tried to tell them how to run their program. They didn't want to listen. And I noticed there were a lot of old wore-out winos that I had drank with and kind of discarded, you know. And occasionally when we came to in jail together, I informed them that they had a drinking problem. And, of course, I didn't have that problem. And today, I really don't believe that I have a drinking problem unless I pick up a drink. I believe that, you know, I'm recovered from the hopeless, helpless state of mind and body only. And that this daily reprieve relates to the fact that there is no cure, and that God will help us today if we ask him. It depends upon our spiritual base. And I really appreciated the third step meeting this morning because they talked a lot about our spiritual base, and I'm a firm believer in God today, and that's a long ways off for an old drunken sailor. I remember when I was in the Navy, and it's quite a ways for me to stand up here and not to use profanity. And one of the gentlemen on the panel talked about not getting rid of his cigarettes. You know, he got rid of his cigarettes through Alcoholics Anonymous, that he said the third step prayer, and all of a sudden his cigarettes were gone. And I don't smoke today, and I smoke three packs a day, and I smoke cigars on top of that. I played cards all the time. I've been in card games in Alcoholics Anonymous that lasted for 3 days, and we had our meals brought in, and they damn near killed me in those games. And I walked out with the money, and I thought that was good AA. I'm happy to be here. Shorty knows I used to be Shorty met me 30 years ago, and before I stayed sober, he came to Boise quite often, and I was around AA a lot in those days, but I didn't realize that you had to, you know, I would go to a meeting and run right out and get drunk. Drunks do that, somebody told me, but In our case, we also become alcoholic and get sober through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's just wonderful to be able to stand up here and not use one word, four-letter words, you know, just to be able to do that, not to make the room blue with my language. And I don't mind talking four-letter words when I talk to a new drunk to meet him on his level, because I was a sailor and I understand the words. And sometimes I believe that it's necessary to communicate at the level we're talking about, because I don't believe people understand us if we talk as we are here when we're talking to a guy all covered up with puke when I'm down in a drunk tank and in detox. I believe that I can help people by talking where they are, but I need to realize that I don't need to stay there very long, because I have a program today that lifts all of us up, and it's a very uplifting experience to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just the tremendous growth we've had, and the fact that from within we are strong. You know, I really appreciate the young people and how to me they're way heads ahead of the way I was when I came here. They got big book groups, you know, and they study hard in the big book, and many of them work really hard in service. And I hope that's the bell that tells me I'd better stop, because that's what I'm going to use it for. And most of us alkies need some kind of a reminder, you know, because we kind of run off into the wild blue yonder. Maybe it's kind of like AA and Al-Anon. I like to talk about Al-Anon because my wife has been a member of Al-Anon for 30 years. And I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 27 years. And I believe that Al-Anon helped very much in getting me started in AA, because my wife is a very loving person, and she stuck with me when I wasn't a very nice guy. And she's an RN. I guess she understood how to clean up the mess. And it took me a long time to stop being that. But today, most of all, I respect the clean clothes I have on, but even more than that, I respect God, and I respect the people that love me enough to teach me about these things, to show me the way, and to hold my hand when I wasn't worthy. But I was worthy, because I was holding the hand of a person who was where I was from. So they understood that compassion and understanding, and that's our real love in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we love each other because we know each other. And we don't fool each other. We either get honest or we get drunk and die. And I thank you very much.
Harry, we have two things in common. My wife, too, is an RN, and she came into Al-Anon shortly after I came into AA. And I've always had something of a resentment against Al-Anon, because I always said that if Al-Anon got her before I went to AA, I wouldn't have had to go to AA. She was the reason I was drinking. Next, we'll call on Claire, who I've known for years and has been tenacious in getting AA in the Lower Valley. And if there's a group that I could say that we could say is our group my group, I think Claire could take that, because he was very instrumental in getting AA going in the Lower Valley, and I can't imagine anybody have the tenacity that he showed in getting that going, which is a good thing going now. Claire?
Thank you, Howard. My name is Claire. I'm an alcoholic. It's really nice to be here. It is. I really wanted to be here. It's really nice to be asked to be here. I look out across the room here, and there's so many people that I know here and feel so close to. It's more than just a privilege. It goes way beyond that. I really wanted to come to this Prophet's Conference in Yakima this year. For some reason, I just really wanted to be here. And I've been thinking about it, quite a bit about it. Howard and numbers of others have already mentioned this particular conference in 1964, which was just on the street here. And this was the first Northwest Conference I came to. I'd been sober 3 years, and I just barely had enough money to get out of Prosser. And we came to Yakima, Doris and I, and I couldn't afford to stay in a hotel, but we got a room across in Yakima Hotel for $3.50 a night, I think it was. And we went to this conference, and I remember listening to the radio that where I was living in Prosper the night before, and it mentioned that there was going to be this conference in Yakima, and that these people would identify themselves by placards on their shirt or lapel, you know. And when I went in and signed up there at this registration desk, and they made out this placard, the pin on my shirt, and I looked around, and what I wanted to do was walk outside so the people out in the street could see it. And I looked around, and nobody's looking, so as soon as it was handy, I walked out in the street, and you know what I seen? The street was full of guys walking down there with placards on their lapels. And nobody was paying any attention to them. And it began to tell me something, and I think then I begin to understand, and after that I become sure that I fit any place in this world that I feel like fitting in. I'm like Barry, you know, that I know where I am, and I know what I am, and most of the time I feel pretty good about it. I know there's a place here for me, and most of the time I feel good about my effort to fill it. I know it's a God-given privilege to be here. So many things have happened in these years. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on September 6th, 1961 at Kennewick. And going back there, you know, some things occurred there early that were new to me. In the first place, when I called, the man told me where his place was, and I went there to see him. And he gave me this address. First place he asked, he'd come after me, told him no, I was okay, I could drive down there. Hell, I was so drunk, I could hardly stand up. But I drove down there, and I began to think that I must have the wrong address because those weren't shacks. It was a new, nicer part of town. And when I came to this house, it was about the nicest one I'd ever seen. And I walked through the portal of this gate, and here was this tall guy sitting in a chair there. And he said, I'll be waiting for you. And he got up and got off that chair and walked to me with his hand out. And I knew that he was waiting for me, and I knew something else without being told. It was something about this man, you know. I didn't know what I was. I just felt it was all right to be there with him. And I know now that that is the thing that made it possible for me to be here, and I think it's the thing that makes it possible for all of us to be here, is to be met on our level, right where we were at that particular time. And I think back in those early meetings, so many things have been going through my mind. Somebody mentioned about women here early, you know. And I think I had been going there for maybe 2 or 3 months, and I realized after about the second meeting there's one woman there, and naturally went through my head, I wondered what she was doing in the place. And after about 2 or 3 months, I got a little confidence. One after meeting was over, one evening after meeting was over, I asked her just what the hell she was doing there. And when she got to explaining to me what she was doing there, I never asked that question again. Boy, she explained that to me in the kind of language that I could really understand. She got right down there, you know. She started, you know, she said, well, just who in the hell do you think you are? And then she began to explain it. And she and her husband had come up, two of her very closest friends. And they'd done so much, not only for me, but for other people. And I've seen these things grow up just in these years that I've been in. This is almost unbelievable, you know. And you think about it, and here last night I was sitting there listening to this lady who's been in Alcoholics Anonymous 45 years, and I realized how little I've really seen. But always there is this other thing, you know, that goes through my mind. If I hadn't come, I wouldn't have seen any of it. It's a gift, the whole thing. Everything that I have is just right here. In a way, I was privileged. I was in the Kennewick a year, and I moved into Prosser. And I think I knew why I moved there, really. Was to try to start a group. I didn't tell myself that, but somebody else did, and I think perhaps I wanted to. And I know that I didn't really start it, but I was nowhere there and made the effort, and the thing got started. So I had a group at Prosser. After being there 3 years, I moved to Seattle, and I went into the White Center area, and the White Center was my home group for some time. So some 10 years or so, and I moved from White Center to Cedar Valley, where I'm living now, and that is my home group. And the same thing happened at Cedar Valley and White Center and Prosser as it did when I came away, when I first walked in that door, still drunk and dirty and sick and stinking. They accepted me just like I was. Just like I was. And so it's really something that we have that perhaps we can't get any other way. I think the things that talking about this book and its teachings, we could read these things in other books. They've been written in other books, and perhaps they've been told to us, but we didn't listen. We didn't listen until we heard them from people just like ourselves. I'm like perhaps some other people think maybe the old way was the best way, and I get looking around, and hell, I don't think there is any old way, really. When I read the book, it hasn't changed. And when I shake hands with these people, those handshakes haven't changed. When I look around these people I've known for 20, 25 years, they're a little bit grayer, and some of them had a little trouble getting around, but they haven't changed. When I meet new people, it's been in 4 or 5 years, the young man just tells me how excited he was about going to a GSR meeting here, coming in Walla Walla, and that hasn't changed. So we have the same thing going, but it's because we're willing to share with other people. The big thing is whether we're willing to accept what these people are talking about. That's what really counts. It's the fact that, we can stay sober, and we will stay sober if we want to, and if we open our minds and listen. The thing about that is, it's a miracle that I was able to hang on until I was able to open my mind, because I couldn't understand anything nor remember anything. The thing that made the difference to me, like, was when Reed met me there, that he got up and shook my hand, and I knew he wanted to shake it. And when I went to those early meetings, that they'd done the same thing. And I can't remember those people telling me that I had to do anything. I can't remember them reading anything, but they were there when I went. And I could hardly wait to be with them. The most important thing was to me was to be with these people. A little later on, after a few weeks, I began to sober up somewhat mentally and begin to think about it. And then I began to the place where I wanted more than anything else just to be like these people. I never questioned what they were, where they came from. I just was sure that they were telling me the truth. They suggested I read, and I tried to read, and I could read the words, but they didn't mean anything. I couldn't remember them. But when I did begin to be able to read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, naturally I began to understand some things that I needed to understand. And a little bit at a time, I presume, in my way, I begin to shape my life with these steps and with these teachings. But always these things rang a bell and meant more to me when I heard them at these AA meetings. Lots of things happened to me that later on I read about in the books I read then I didn't know. For instance, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, there was at times I wanted to drink so bad I didn't think I could possibly make it again. I think I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous from 2 or 3 years before. I remember reading in Bob's story that the urge for him to drink is with him constantly. And I hear people today talk about it, you know, and all I can do is just the same thing that they told me, Clary, it's going to be all right. And those things are meaningful to me. I remember I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous a few months, maybe 3, and a man gave me a big book. He doesn't know today that I know who would give it to me. But he had just barely money enough to buy 2 of them, and he bought one for himself and one for me. Later, years later on, I loaned that book to a lot of people before it finally disappeared. One time I loaned it to a man in a county jail at Prosser, and 2 years later a patrolman said he wanted to speak to me down at the city jail, and I thought back, and I couldn't remember having done anything. So I went down there, and he had this book about Alcoholics Anonymous. He stopped a guy on the road hitchhiking. And he had this package, and he asked his patrolman if he ever stopped in Prosser. He said he did occasionally. He told me he'd borrowed this book from a man there in AA, and he'd like to have him take it back to him. But this particular book, I remember I'd been in a year, and I made a trip to Los Angeles. And I put this book underneath the seat of a little truck I had bought. And there wasn't quite room enough. I wouldn't go back there far enough. I never took that book out of there, but I could put my heel against it. I could feel it. And it's about that close to me yet. I don't always read it as often as I should, but it's there all of the time, and it's never hidden. I'm aware of it all of the time. I see so many people here, you know. I think of some of the things that I've shared with so many people. I seen Raymond here when I came in yesterday, and I was thinking about the things that we've done together. And so many people, it's just impossible to get it all out, you know. It just is impossible. I don't know. I had been in maybe a month or two or maybe three, I don't know, when they started what they called a study meeting there in Kennewick, had it on a Tuesday night. I learned something there was meaningful to me, too. I went down there, and I wasn't feeling good about it, and there was only four or five people there, and there was a young guy there about 21, 22 years old, and I didn't like the idea of that. I didn't figure he's old enough to be there. And I wanted to drink, and right above you could hear the damn tavern up there banging away, you know. And when they talked, why, I listened, and when this young guy talked, why, those years dropped away, and he had really been through the mill. But I still wanted to drink, and when they got up, they closed it with a serenity prayer, I'm pretty sure, and I wanted to drink, and I headed out of there. And this young man backed out of that room in front of me. It wasn't easy for him. He just had one leg. A couple of years before, he tried to commit suicide down in Los Angeles. He hopped under a freight train and just chopped off one leg. He backed up the stairs in front of me, and that wasn't easy, I'm sure. He backed out through the door in front of me, and he got out in front of me, right in front of me in the street. And I could see his face by the light, and I don't recall, I'm sure he didn't say, "Do you want to drink, Claire," or "Don't want to drink." He was just talking to me. And I realized that more than anything else, this one young man wanted me not to go drink because he knew what had happened to me. I'm sure that he saved my life. I'm sure of it. So I learned there, you know, that age and this sort of thing has nothing to do with it. And the book tells me that. And these people are talking here this morning tell me that, and I need to remember it. I need to keep myself in position to share what little I have with anybody who needs it. Here a few years ago in Seattle, I was privileged to get a call from a man from Bombay, India. He was a captain of a ship. As a matter of fact, he owned it. And he'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous 4 years, and he depended on tapes and on correspondence because he couldn't get ashore. When he came in, usually he was so busy he couldn't get ashore. But he had a chance to do that, and he called me, and I took a day off. I had one coming anyway. I took a day off, and he liked to wore me out. I hauled him around to meetings all over. And he meant an awful lot to me, and he introduced himself. He said, I wouldn't remember his first initials, but they were AA, and his last name was Nazareth, so he was AA Nazareth. And after he left, he gave me his address and his shipping agent's address there in Seattle. And a year later, I was up at Penticton, Canada. And a friend of mine and a friend of a lot of you people, Ralph B., was speaking up there. And I got a tape of that, and I mailed it to him. And it was about two or three months later before it got to him, I guess, through a shipping agent and whatnot. And he finally got it, and he sent me a little thank you, Graham, with it. And I appreciate it. And with it, he put a little card in with it. And I carry a lot of these things in my pocket. I haven't made it 100 at a time. And I need to know this. And it says, "Lest we forget, remember that helping others and rent be paid for our stay here on this earth." And we need to remember that. Thank you.
Talk about loaning books. I don't know how many I've lost, but recently I had someone come to me that had been to Goodwill in Sunnyside and bought a big book for 25 cents, and my name was in the front of it. We got to move along here, and I'd like to have Al with us, please.
Wow, it's been great, hasn't it? Up to this point. My name is Al, and I am a recovered alcoholic. It's nice to be here, and it is a privilege to be allowed to be up here this morning in front of you. I know why I'm up here. When I go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I know why I'm there. And I think we all should know that, because it's quite plain to me. I'm sure it will be plain to you, too. We're here to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. That's all we get to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous is this guy. When I was privileged to be driven into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was one meeting a week in the town of Bremerton. There was one meeting a week in the town of Port Orchard. There was one meeting a week in Bainbridge Island. And Bainbridge Island was a floating meeting. And you're lucky if you can find it. And you know, it's really grown by leaps and by bounds, and it really should. If some of the things I'm hearing from our delegate is true, and I'm sure they are, we do have a lot of people that are just waiting to get through the door. But what happened was that we needed more meetings because we got more people interested in themselves in getting sober. And I think we still need more meetings because we still have more people interested in getting sober. But unless we tell them exactly what it is, we're going to do them a great disservice. And I don't think we should water down the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That book hasn't changed. I have changed. And the book has changed for me. And when I read the book, it will change more for me. But it is great to be here. I'm not going to take much time because I want to hear Natalie, and I'm sure you do too. And we do want to close on time. That's one thing in AA that my sponsor told me when I got here. At the time, I didn't know he was my sponsor. But he was. And he said, "We're going to go to a meeting tonight, Al." He picked me up, and I did. That was my first mistake. Should never done that. I said, he should have picked me up. That's what it should have been. But anyway, he said, "When I get there," he says, "I want you to sit there and shut up. I don't want to hear nothing out of you." He says, "You haven't got anything to offer." And he says, "You'll hear things that you need to hear." He says, "Besides, you'll be a very, very big part of that meeting. You'll serve as a horrible example." Well, you know, he almost drove me out of AA. The only trouble was I wasn't in AA yet. And I think that's one of the things we have to watch out today, is that we don't become afraid of running someone out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will never run anyone out of Alcoholics Anonymous if they want to get sober. All right, the book talks about resentment, doesn't it? It says resentments are the number one killer, right? Well, I stand here and I tell you this, friends. Thank God for resentments. Without resentments, you won't grow an inch. It takes a lot of work to resolve a resentment. And you're the one that's going to have to resolve that resentment. If you don't, it'll kill you. Because the resentment in this human body is just like the garbage can in the kitchen. And I'm sure all the guys and the gals alike know that if you throw a fish head in that kitchen, in that garbage can, and then you keep throwing scraps in on top of it, it won't be long before that garbage can will not only drive you out of the kitchen, it'll drive you out of the house. And that's how resentments are with us. We keep chugging them down, and finally we can't get rid of them. And this is what's dangerous. So I go to resentment. If I go to a meeting and don't get a resentment, I feel cheated. I really do. Because who needed you when times were good? I didn't need you. They told me, "You have a problem with alcohol, Al?" I said, "Hell no. I was able to drink with either hand when I got here. What's this problem they're talking about?" You know? But like I said, it's time for me to shut up and let Natalie get up here and talk. But I think the bottom line is this. And it's not mine. Whatever I've got here, I've picked up somewhere. That when I came here, I had to drink, and now I don't. And that's the bottom line. Thank you.
I want it known that I am not a sexist. We did not keep our lady to the last, and I have a great deal of respect for her, and I wish she'd tell so. Natalie?
Thank you very much. My name is Natalie, and I am an alcoholic. And I would like to say that to you, Claire, I'm sorry I left for a moment during your talk. But the bladder is going a bit, Claire. And not only that, it's like if I known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. So, a great honor. There are times that you'd like to stop the clock because of the situation and the uniqueness of this room today. I would particularly like to pay my very grateful respects to those who went there before me and those who are coming after me or here when I came. Particularly want to pay my respects to my two service sponsors. I'm a little emotional this morning. I guess it doesn't matter, but I am. I guess it's just all of a sudden this great spiritual atmosphere is overwhelming. But to my two service sponsors, Eric Bergman and Ralph Brexis. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous August 15th, 1959, into the Bellevue group. My sponsor was a woman by the name of Mary O'Connors, who really put together what is termed as the Bellevue group. Now, when she came out here, she really had a lot of courage. I was going to use something else, because she was a great lady, but she had strong purpose. In other words, she was not a pushy broad, is what I'm trying to get around. But she had been very active on the East Coast in AA. And she couldn't find a group. Now, she had heard about some men who were holed up out in Bothell, who let nobody in, and God was not even know about them. But finally, she pursued the fact of finding these men, and then she wanted to have a group in Bellevue. I think she lived in Bellevue or Mercer Island at that time. Well, they were not very interested in this woman. But she promised to bake them cookies. God, I'll tell you, isn't it terrible? I hate to say things like that. Don't plan on a cookie from me. I buy them. But that's what she did, and she got a place, and they met, and that's how the Bellevue group basically started. Well, also then, she had another rather unusual idea at that time. They should celebrate birthdays. Well, no one had ever thought about birthdays. Come to find out, no one had been sober a year, so there was no reason to celebrate at that time. So I don't know if that's how the birthday cake started in the greater Seattle area or where I'm from, but nevertheless, that was certainly one area that it came about happening. When I got a call to come here, it happens to women more than men. They almost apologize. Well, I'm sorry, but you are an old-timer. I mean, I don't think they say it to men. It's a source of pride. Well, I want you to know it's a source of pride for me also. I do not mind being an old-timer. I will be 62 years old this coming August, along the same month that my sobriety comes about. And I particularly also want to thank the Pacific Northwest Conference and all the people who have been involved in it all throughout the years, and particularly this committee, because last year, of course, we were did not have one because of the international that was held in Montreal. Pacific Northwest Conference means a great deal to me. I think I went to the first one in 1961. Was that in Seattle, Eric? Okay, I do. It's getting so now I don't remember who was what and what was who and who spoke when, and gee whiz. It's my mind is just filled with all this AA life that I have lived for so long. It's become such a part of me. But the Pacific Northwest Conference, I was sober then about 2 years. And things were not like they are today. I mean, I was not happy, joyous, and free, is about the best way to put it. I was happy, joyous, and free maybe for about 5 or 10 minutes out of a 24-hour plant. That's about the best way to express that. But I had come into AA, I would have said I was unemployable. I had 2 small children. One was 18 months old, one was 3, still in diapers. I was 34 years old. I felt 89. I didn't know anybody who was like me. I didn't know there was a disease called alcoholism. And I was very spiritually blessed in the fact that I had no place else to go. And AA came into my life, and these 2 women took me in and loved me unconditionally. I sensed that from the time they came. But what a time I have had in AA. What a time I have had at going to the First Pacific Northwest Conference. And I think Dr. Earl was a speaker then, but it was at the big hall or wherever we were. I remember the big hall so strongly because, you see, Seattle was always... I've always been a part of what you call Greater Seattle AA because that's where the action was in those days, and that's where the old-timers were, and it was... You can go in a place and you can meet somebody and somehow you can sense that you have tapped a winning spiritual source. And I knew where it was. And it was just like a beacon light to me to be over there and to just... I wasn't more in awe than now. They're just ordinary people now. I mean, they've got lots of character defects, and I can tell you a few of them. But I've also exposed myself enough so they know mine. But in those days, I was absolutely in awe of everything, and what I heard were like words were the same, but the message was so powerful that it. I can remember the first one. It held me high, like on a mountaintop for days, until I had to come down to reality and face the fact that my marriage wasn't very good and I didn't have a job and I had children. How was I going to get sober? What was the 4th and 5th step? How was I going to get through a day? And all those things. And I've always had those kinds of experiences that have uplifted me, so I have not had to stay within myself when I was so very sick and so miserable and so without. Not very long ago, in the process of developing the history, which I think this is an absolute kick, they had a meeting in the greater Bellevue area and they gathered in the GSRs and they asked me to come. Because they wanted to make a plan on how they were going to get the history on the District 13. So I went there and they all kind of talked about what they were going to do about getting the old timers out of the woods over there. And there's not that many. Well, I am sitting there and they are talking about when they're going to have this meeting, how they're going to conduct it, and where it will be, and all the framework of this meeting, and they said, well, I think we'll have to have it in the afternoon. I don't think that anyone will be able to get out at night. I mean, how old can you get? And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, my God, and I says, and they were, who was going to pick them up? And, I mean, it got to be really rather amusing. So someone offered to get me in case I had to have my afternoon nap at 3 o'clock. And then someone said they would take me on home in case I didn't drive. And what is absolutely, as I said, hysterical, I was the only marathon runner in the whole room. And so, anyway, we did have the meeting at noontime just so none of us would cave in and kind of not make it throughout the day. Well, I could not help but think about the road I have traveled and where I came from. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I could hardly make it 3 miles down the road to the liquor store or to get anything to drink. And from coming into AA, I have had an experience that is almost non-ordinary. It can happen to every one of us, but somehow certain things have come my way. probably just by hanging around, by being with people who are like you. But I had a thrill. I guess this, a thrill is okay to say that. Although it's a rather light way to put it. In Montreal, I was one of 21 trustees who walked across that stadium because of my coming from the grassroots AA, as Shorty talks about. That somehow or another, I have been privileged to serve the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in a very special way. The experience is hard to describe. I will be rotating off as of July at the forum in next week or so. I don't think, in a sense, it's going to be that easy for me to rotate off. I love action. Hate trouble, love action, which doesn't make sense. I will miss the members of the board. They are like my brothers and sisters. I have nothing but awe. I'm in awe of the members of the board of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will miss them. Also, in going off the board, it is so strong within me about the strength of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Look, the people in this room could sober up the world. I mean, what problem could we possibly have? There is the strength that is there within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the dedication of the members that you do not find in ordinary situations. It is basically how we stay sober. Shorty was mentioning about the group. Everyone in this room, I'm sure, has a home group. We are a part of the grassroots from that source. I will go back to my home group and be a part of that home group in whatever way, and certainly not in a way of serving in the way that I have for these lengths of years. Sometimes just sitting down and being present in a state of meditation and prayer, of being in a room, is sufficient. And of being very careful to listen to other people and to give them time and thought and a caring. A caring does not come by something I had when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. A caring is developed spiritually. But I will tell each of every one of you here that your pathway to your spiritual process of awakening will come through service. Thank you.
I'd like to apologize to everyone here that we have had to hold these people down to the amount of time we have. I'm sure we'd all like to hear them with at least an hour, and inasmuch as we are having to break this off, and we have done fairly well. I got to compliment all of the people on here. So with that, we'll close the old timers meeting, and may we stand in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.